Welcome to a special edition of the show that normally comes on after the lunch special, Shedding Lights. And it's a show that tries to shed light on different subjects that might be pertinent and important to all of us. And we're coming up on the anniversary of the terrible attacks in New York. We know them now as the 9/11 attacks. The World Trade Center towers fell down that day, along with another building. And a lot of stuff has swirled around that event. And there's raised up a movement of folks from all walks of life that are questioning what we were told as far as the official story goes. And on the phone with us right now, as part of this two-hour special, I have the author of Still Seeking the Truth About 9/11, Exposing Fallacies in the Official Story, Paul W. Ray, Ph.D. Paul Ray, welcome to KZSU Airwaves.
Thank you, Bert. Very happy to be aboard.
Thank you. Thank you for being part of this two-hour special. And one of the main reasons we're doing this on Labor Day is because the 6th Annual 9/11 Truth Film Festival is happening this coming weekend. It's going to be in three different venues around the Bay Area. You're going to be involved in it. It's going to be in San Francisco, Oakland, and San Leandro. It's a film festival, and there are speakers as well. I think you're going to be at least introducing somebody, if not speaking yourself, right?
Yeah, that's right.
But why don't we start with having you just introduce yourself and tell the folks who you are and how you came to all this.
Okay. About, let's see, 2003, while I was still teaching at St. Mary's College, I started looking at some of the contradictions and some of the things that just didn't add up in the government account, and also noticing how the 9/11 attacks seemed to be very conveniently serving the government in terms of its plans to attack Afghanistan and then Iraq. So that aroused suspicions because of my awareness of a pattern in using contrived incidents to promote wars.
Uh-huh.
And so from that point on, really, I pretty much shelved a lot of my other research and writing in order to focus on 9/11. And, of course, I did the book, Still Seeking the Truth of 9/11 book. And then since then, I've been working on an expanded item, which will be coming out next year, called Mounting Evidence. So there's just more and more evidence coming in all the time.
And I had a chance to read your book, Still Seeking the Truth, which is out of print now, over the weekend. And it raised a lot of awareness with me just about stuff that we don't normally think about. And I want to talk to you about the book. But what's your background? Were you a political activist before 9/11 happened?
Yes, I've been a political activist really since the civil rights movement and the Vietnam period. So I have a long history of involvement with social justice and particularly peace work. But I guess, like many people, I was personally shocked and distraught by the attacks of 9/11, and my critical faculties were a bit dulled until I got over some of the emotional stuff and started taking a hard look at the evidence.
And I want to kind of unpack that part of it, too. We all came to it in different ways. For myself, I went a little crazy right after 9/11, just thinking that we've been attacked by terrorists, and I thought maybe we'd get bombed again. And I'm here at Stanford a lot, and I thought, who knows? You know, maybe they'll go after some institution like this.
Sure.
And I heard Michael Rupert on a new show on KPFA called Guns and Butter with Bonnie Faulkner.
Right.
And she was talking to Michael Rupert. I happened to be, I was at one of these department stores, and I was looking for a radio, and I was testing out different radios, and I happened in the middle of the afternoon, and I happened to just put it on KPFA. And what I heard coming out of the radio just floored me. Michael Rupert, one of the early researchers of the 9/11 movement, probably one of the first guys to even really publish stuff on it.
Right.
Was speaking to Bonnie Faulkner on KPFA and laying it out, you know, just bare bones, laying it out that there was a grand conspiracy, mm-hmm. and it wasn't like they told us. And the more I heard, the more intrigued I got. And I went out and got whatever videos I could on Michael Rupert. And first of all, I'd like you to tell the folks how it came to you. Was it just a gradual thing, and day by day after 9/11, you decided that it wasn't the truth, or was there some moment? Richard Gage of 9/11 of Engineers and Architects heard Bonnie Faulkner one day and pulled the car over to the side of the road, and his life was changed forever. Well, right. What's your story on that? How did you come to the 9/11? Conclusion that okay. It wasn't all right.
Well, it wasn't a burning bush on the road to Damascus,
okay.
but it perhaps a little more gradual, because I was having to push aside denial. In other words, first one starts with the official story of surprise attacks, and then maybe one opens the door a little bit psychologically and moves into, well, maybe there was a lot of foreknowledge, and maybe the government let it happen. And then sometimes people open the door still a little farther, and they get to the point of, well, maybe the government helped it happen. And then some go still farther and entertain the idea that the government made it happen. And I kind of went through those kind of stages.
And at some point, you got the wherewithal to write this book. The book, we're talking to Paul Ray, Ph.D., Paul W. Ray, that's R-E-A, Professor Emeritus, correct, Paul?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Which means you're retired now from teaching.
Right. Right.
And the name of the book is Still Seeking the Truth About 9/11, Exposing Fallacies in the Official Story. And there was one edition, and then what I have in my hand, with a little red panel on the lower left corner, it says updated, expanded, late 2005 edition. So I guess you put out a second edition from the first one that you put out, huh? Mm-hmm.
That's correct, yeah. We really wanted to get something out that was short, readable, accessible, and affordable.
Mm-hmm.
And so that little black book did sell. We sold it for about $5, and people liked it.
And it's by Bayside. It's on Bayside Press,
right?
And the edition I have is January 2006. And I guess people would have to find it as a used book now. Like you said, it's out of print, right?
Yes, right.
Still Seeking the Truth About 9/11, Exposing the Fallacies and Official Story, Paul W. Ray. Now, in reading your book, Paul, I did come up with some serious questions that I want to pose to you. And the first one is, can you briefly give us the definition of false flag or a false flag operation, and
sure.
then run down a little brief history of how false flag operations have been used to get America into war.
Okay, sure. False flag is a particular type of contrived event where governments make it appear that a certain designated opponent, soon-to-be enemy government, has committed an act when actually they are doing it, they are staging the event themselves. And a perfect example of a false flag would be the Gulf of Tonkin incident, which is probably quite familiar to many of your listeners. And that was, of course, in 1964 when there were reports of North Vietnamese PT boats attacking U.S. destroyers in the Gulf of Tonkin, and it turned out that there were no North Vietnamese PT boats, but and no attack. But the way it was reported was to make it seem that America was under attack, and then, of course, Lyndon Johnson went to Congress, and the rest is tragic history.
It's amazing, too, that you bring that one up, because nowadays, when you say the Gulf of Tonkin incident, most people who study history understand that that was a false flag event, even if they don't know the term false flag. Most people, it's general knowledge in the United States that, yeah, we got lied to on that day. And isn't it amazing how, well, 57,000 Americans died, 3 million Vietnamese, and it just, oh, well, yeah, they lied to us. And not that nobody doesn't, not that anybody doesn't care. Everybody cares. But it brings me to wonder, the whole 9/11 truth movement, how long is it going to take before, in the psyche of America, hopefully one day, it will be accepted that we were lied to after that day? And again, this is my opinion. I'm on Stanford Radio, and these opinions are mine and the guests too. I'm wondering how long it's going to take before a majority of the public comes to realize that we were lied to that day, and a lot of that story just doesn't make sense. That's what we're going to cover in the rest of this hour.
Sure. Well, you know, speaking to this very point, I think there's a tendency for well-meaning, fairly well-informed Americans to compartmentalize and think, well, this was the Gulf of Tonkin, and yes, it had terrible effects and led to a totally wasteful war and all of this, but this was the exception. And when, in point of fact, it was not the exception that most major wars, I think arguably you could say all major wars that the country has ever been in have involved contrived events and provocations.
Now, just to give the listener a feel for some of the real meat of your study of this subject, I want to jump ahead a little bit, because what I was really struck with in reading your book this weekend was the contradictions of the 9/11 Commission, and even from the start of the commission, there was such controversy because the president and vice president fought it all the way.
Right.
And they didn't want it to happen. They even made a compromise. They said they would talk at the commission. They would speak and be questioned, but it couldn't be recorded. It
right.
couldn't be broadcast. It had to be under lock and key. It was so much secrecy. It just leads me to wonder if another kind of president, say the one that we have now, tried to do something like that, they'd probably hang this guy out to dry.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently these two guys got a real pass. And I'd like you to go over briefly that part of your book that spoke about all the different contradictions and the changing of people's testimonies in the night. Yeah, that's right, folks. The changing of people's testimonies. After they had testified, testimony was changed, and the fight that the government put up. And the 9/11 families were the ones that really helped make this happen. Speak of the 9/11 Commission and how apparently wrong it was.
Oh, boy. That's just a very rich topic, and briefly, I think you're quite right in underscoring that the Bush administration strongly resisted an investigation. And again, they were way out of the historical pattern, whereas right after the Kennedy assassination, we had a Warren Commission within 10 days. Now, not to say that the Warren Commission did a good job. Obviously, they did not. But at least there was a pattern that the Bush administration totally pushed aside and waited 1,000 days before they finally were forced into getting some sort of official investigation underway. Then, of course, there, as you say, there were all kinds of contradictions in the military testimony, where you had two different Pentagon timelines going into that period. In other words, over the 2.5-year period, the Pentagon had come out with two different, very different timelines, which tended to be self-serving and basically butt-covering on the Pentagon's part, moving times around so that it looked like they didn't have time to get fighters in the air and all of this sort of thing. So then the commission went ahead and just overrode a lot of the Pentagon's own manipulated timelines and manipulated them further, protecting the Pentagon and of course the administration from the appearance of screwing up.
And it's interesting too, because in reading the book, you very carefully, very meticulously give cross references where you got your information, and a lot of it came from mainstream media sources,
right?
From reliable sources, and you meticulously put it in there. So this isn't just you talking about something you think that happened. This is the fact. The other part of the commission that really struck me strangely was all the strange connections that all the commissioners had to, and I want you to speak about that now, because each one of the commissioners is tainted in his own way, almost as if they were handpicked to help sabotage the real meat of getting at the truth of this.
Boy, that's, again, a statement that might sound extreme to say that practically every member of the commission was handpicked, but when you look down the roster, you can really see the different interests that different commissioners were apparently chosen to represent. In other words, certain kinds of things that that person would be self-interested in making sure did not get into the official story that emerged from the commission's report. And we could start with the, not actually a commissioner, but the first choice to head the commission was none other than Henry Kissinger. And this, of course, was just astounding, just jaw-dropping, that someone with a long history of involvement in deception and manipulation and warmongering and all kinds of such things would be then chosen to head the commission. I mean, this was just a huge red flag going up the flagpole, and there was a howl mostly from the families about the obvious conflicts of interest with Kissinger. So they got him out, but then they, in his place, they got in on someone else with a long record of deception, and that was Lee Hamilton, who had practically made a specialty of doing cover-ups in Washington, and he had done several before, either himself or in connection with co-chairs and committees and things like that. I mean, he was a specialist in cover-ups.
I had never heard that about Lee Hamilton. Who was doing the picking of the commissioners, by the way, Paul Ray?
The White House was quite influential, and Congress had some hand in it, but it was mostly the White House, which, of course, again, screamed of conflict of interest, because since when does someone being investigated get to choose the investigators?
Mm-hmm. And we've jumped ahead a little bit, because we're going to go back to that day in a little bit and find out where everybody was, where all the players were, and it's all been testified to. Richard Clark was very transparent in stating where he knew everybody was. He was at the White House, but he wasn't allowed down in the basement.
Right.
And a lot of strange stories like that. But one thing that really helped the commission get away with what it got away with was media silence, or the total, I don't know, this is almost like some kind of sleight of hand game that the media has pulled on this thing, isn't it?
It really is. You know, it again might sound glib, but I think you could argue, even if you don't want to see 9/11 as a conspiracy, you certainly have to accept the fact that the cover-up was a conspiracy.
Yes, definitely. And another thing you pointed out, too, you wrote a great article with Mickey Huff, who's now the director of Project Censored, about the media's role in this. And I love the title of the article, too. Mickey Huff will be on at the top of the next hour speaking with us here. Deconstructing Deceit, 9/11, the Media, and Myth Information. Not misinformation, myth information.
Yeah.
And what I loved in there was you guys talked about the fact that it wasn't just the right-wing media or the mainstream media. There was progressive left media right up into things like The Nation magazine.
Right.
That has fought the entire idea of even having a discussion of what might have happened that day. Speak about the whole media thing, all the way up to the progressive media, and how it's fought all the way.
Yes, that's a huge problem, and you could include the progressive along with the Nation. You could include Norman Solomon and many other media critics or otherwise progressive critics. War activists, anti-war activists, and so forth. People that you'd expect would have seen a connection between the 9/11 events and the expansion of the military budget and the intelligence expansions and civil liberties that are compromised and things like that. But unfortunately, they have really blocked that, at least publicly. And I think the reason, one major reason, is that they are so afraid of losing what little credibility they may have with the larger audiences, that they're just very afraid of being associated with anyone that's making a little more radical critique and raising questions about possible government complicity.
We're talking to Paul Ray, Paul W. Ray, Ph.D., emeritus retired professor, wrote the first book, Still Seeking the Truth, about 9/11, exposing fallacies in the official story. And there's an expanded version. Both of them are out of print. You'd have to get them at a used bookstore. And they came out on Bayside Press. But, Paul, you have a brand new book coming out called Mounting Evidence. Is that going to also be on Bayside Press?
No. I'm going to probably do that with iUniverse, which allows me to stay very current on the research right up toward the 10-year celebration next year.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically self-publishing, but they do a very good job. I have a number of author friends who publish with iUniverse, and they get a book out in about 2 months, as opposed to regular publishers that, of course, take much longer.
Very cool. Paul, just for people's interest that might be piqued right now, if they want to get a hold of your work, see some of your articles, I'm sure you have a website, huh?
I don't yet, but okay. I certainly will in time for the new book.
And what they could probably do, though, is if they Googled your name, information would probably come up on your writings.
That's true, and certainly that article that you mentioned with Mickey Huff.
Yeah.
That would pop right up on Project Censored and 911truth.org and several other places.
Mm-hmm. And it's Paul, W-R-E-A, Paul Ray. And just Google that if you want to get more information on that. And, Paul, you're going to be part of, want to let people know, really pump this up. This weekend is the 6th annual, right here in the Bay Area, the 6th annual 9/11 Truth Film Festival. And it's going to be held at the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland on Thursday. Then it's going to also be held in San Francisco and San Leandro. It's going to be at the Viz Cinema in San Francisco. That's in Japantown. And that'll be on Friday and Saturday. And simultaneously, it'll be happening, the film festival will be happening at Bal Cinema, the historic Bal Theater in San Leandro.
Correct.
And that's going to be happening on Saturday and I believe Sunday, too. And all this can be found at the SF 911truth.org. So if you just Google SF 911truth.org, you'll have the entire schedule of the film festival. You're going to be speaking there as well, too, Paul, right?
Yes, right. The full schedule and the all the information is posted, and the Grand Lake event is the kickoff. It's coming starting on Thursday, as you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's an all-day affair, too. It's not just at night, right?
Right. The others are not as full a program, but the Grand Lake will be starting at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and there will be speakers from representing all of the different 9/11 truth groups around the state. That's a highlight of that particular program.
Very cool. Now, let's get back to the event. What I want to start with is, on that day, the president and the vice president, if we take just those two guys, now everybody's heard the story. Michael Moore had it in his movie, Fahrenheit 9/11. Michael Moore was fortunate enough to get a hold of the film footage from the TV crew that was in the classroom that day with President Bush.
Right.
And he showed that on the movie, so we've all seen it. He had a very strange look on his face that day, especially after he got told that the buildings had been hit.
Right.
And in your investigations, what did you find out about what President Bush was doing, what he did, what he didn't do, what we expect he might have done. You know, he's the president. He should be the shot caller. He probably should have been back at the White House or in a command plane calling the shot somewhere. And also, the vice president. What did you find out about what he was doing, where he was at, and what he did and didn't do? Why don't you run over that a little bit?
Sure. Well, there's a lot of strangeness on both the Florida and D.C. fronts. With Bush in Florida, there were, of course, a lot of strange things going on, and one of them surrounded the fact that Bush was allowed to stay in a publicly announced building, unprotected school in Sarasota. And, I mean, here you had demonstrable attacks going on, and obviously when there's a terrorist attack, a president is a likely target. And nevertheless, somehow the Secret Service seemed very confident that there would be a no attack on Bush. And so people have wondered, well, how is it that they lingered, even dawdled, at the elementary school in Sarasota when their charge as Secret Service would have been to get him out of there as fast as possible. So he not only lingered in the classroom for 9 minutes, which Michael Moore showed, but then gave a TV talk and just kind of hung out and didn't get out of there for well over a half an hour after the second tower had been hit. So that's very strange. And so we kind of wonder, well, did the Secret Service know something we didn't, that they would not have been more concerned for their own lives as well as that of the president? Then in Washington, of course, we have Cheney, according to the official story, being taken at 9:18 from his office when the Secret Service came in and scooped him out of his chair and took him down to the White House bunker. However, there is very ample evidence that Cheney was in the bunker much earlier, more like about 9:05 or 9:07. And this is important because a lot of things were going on then that Cheney later denied being involved with. Whereas if he were in the bunker early, then he would have more responsibility for managing or mismanaging the nation's defenses.
This is another one of the things you dug up, and I really enjoyed this part. There was a young military officer that came in, and it was a crucial time because Cheney was basically, the way the story we've been told, the way Cheney has told it, is was there a stand down? Did somebody tell the Air Force to not go out that day? And it's cloudy what happened. And Cheney said one thing, but this instance where this young officer came in, can you speak about that?
Right. This is one of the key pieces of evidence that we have, and this occurred according to Norman Mineta, the Secretary of Transportation, who was in the bunker and observed a young assistant coming in and saying, we've got an incoming aircraft 50 miles out. Then he popped back in again, aircraft 30 miles out, and then finally he said, aircraft 10 miles out. And Cheney swung around in his chair and snarled, hey, the order still stands. And so this was taken by the commission to mean that that Cheney had given a shoot-down order and that there was going to be an attempt to shoot down this incoming aircraft, when actually, when you look at when this happened, which is about 9:30, just prior to the Pentagon impact, that it then becomes clear that the young lieutenant was basically saying, are you sure you don't want to shoot down this aircraft? It's only 10 miles out. And so essentially he was questioning Cheney for Cheney's unwillingness to activate air defenses against this incoming plane. And so the commission tried to twist this all around, and by having Cheney come in late to the bunker and so forth, have this be about the Flight 93, which was, of course, went down in Pennsylvania at 10:06. So the commission tried to, again, pull a time change so that it would not appear that Cheney actively shut down air defenses, allowing an impact on the Pentagon.
And is this one of those spots where the commission might have changed some of the testimony or fiddled with the numbers?
Well, they certainly fiddled with the time, although they really just didn't want to deal with this at all. In fact, they took the testimony from the Secretary of Transportation right out of their report, and they also canned the videotape version of it. And it's taken Freedom of Information Act pressure to free up the transcript and the videotape. So that's how much they didn't want this incident with Cheney basically doing a stand down, that the commission didn't want to go anywhere near that.
And this plays right into the whole media angle that we were exploring a little earlier. Where was the independent media in this country screaming with their hair on fire when they were changing all this? And maybe you didn't know that day, but when the commission came out, when the final commission report came out, I believe Dr. David Ray Griffin wrote a book on this, right?
Yes, he did.
So he did, but I mean, where is any kind of media that would dig this up? It takes undercover reporters, folks such as yourself, who aren't really, you're not a professional journalist, you're a professor, but I mean, it takes people from all different walks of life to jump on this thing and try to ferret it out. I thought our Fourth Estate was supposed to be the one to bring that to us.
You're so right. If you'll pardon the cliche, the silence was deafening.
Yeah.
The media just was totally asleep at the switch, uncritical about the report, which was just rife with contradictions. One of the few people to speak up was Senator Mark Dayton of Minnesota on the Senate floor, and basically said, "What's going on here? This is just ridiculous. We're not going to buy this kind of story." But very few papers picked that up. I mean, here's a senator speaking, questioning the commission's report, but it was not picked up by any of the wire services or major papers. It was just the Minneapolis papers that reported on that particular protest. And as far as generating critique or careful analysis, there was extremely little.
Talking to Paul W. Ray, the author of Still Seeking the Truth About 9/11, Exposing Fallacies in the Official Story, and has a brand new book coming out, Mounting Evidence. You can find out all about his work if you Google his name, Paul W-R-E-A, Paul Ray. And are you working on a website? You working on getting something up?
Yeah, I will be in the next few months.
Yeah, you'll have to. If you got a new book coming out, you got to have a website, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You're so right.
Definitely. It's so amazing because, I mean, you could spend, you probably did spend hours researching the book. I know it.
Yep,
we could spend hours here on the air going over these questions. It's amazing. Now, one of the big things that sticks out in my mind is we have the tightest, heavy-dutiest, we brag on it every day, the news media does too, air defense system in this country.
Right.
And places like the Pentagon and the White House are ringed with air defenses that if a private jet or a little private plane strays into their airspace, they'll be vaporized within seconds without, you know, nobody even blinks an eye. They just, bam, take them out, dude. You know,
right.
And there's some kind of 5 or 10 mile zone with the White House and probably the Pentagon too, right?
Yes, right.
And so on that day, this is where it gets very, very screwball, because in my mind, I'm asking, where's the Air Force? How come those planes were allowed to stay in the air as long as, what, up to an hour, hour and a half, hour and 15 minutes?
Yeah, right.
And it was known that they were hijacked. And before we even talk about the FAA and NORAD and who didn't call who and who said what to who, and that was a whole mess too, let's speak a little bit about what you found out about the air defense system in this country, because it's very amazing. They either weren't allowed to show up. Was there a stand-down order? And that goes back to Dick Cheney and the vice presidency too. Speak about what you found out about the whole air defense debacle on that day.
Yeah, well, starting with D.C., which you mentioned, Bert, there is a designated zone called the P-56 area, which includes the White House and most of the District of Columbia. And this is very tightly controlled airspace with its own special air controller, which watches for any planes that stray into the P-56 area. So that is definitely a question mark, particularly because there are multiple reports that the plane or possibly missile that struck the Pentagon, whatever it was, the unidentified flying object that hit the Pentagon, did come over the city of Washington and was heading directly toward the White House before veering off to do a sort of grand loop and descent over the Pentagon. So that would certainly have tickled those defenses, which are very sensitive, as you've suggested. And so there are real questions about why those kind of anti-aircraft defenses were not activated, and we've heard very little about that. Another piece to it is that there's a major air base, most of us have heard of Andrews Air Base, which is located just 10 miles from the Pentagon, and whose whole purpose is to defend the Capitol, the government, and it's home to Air Force One and so forth. And Andrews was just totally bypassed. In fact, they offered help to the bunker with Cheney and the others very early on after the second impact into the towers, and they were just kind of put on hold. They were literally said, "Oh, we'll call you back if we need any help." So, I mean, here you have the base that was designated to protect Washington that was essentially marginalized, and as part of that marginalization, you had two jets from Andrews that were on a training mission over in North Carolina. And so they were in the air, three F-16s. And there was a lot of stalling from Andrews recalling those planes that were in the air, and they could have been recalled much more promptly to get them putting a air cover over Washington. So there's a couple factors right there. We could go into a number of others.
Yeah, there's so much. That could be each one of these questions I've asked you could be an entire hour show.
Definitely.
If you laid it out exactly what happened. It's just amazing. Now, one of the really strange things that always struck me funny, and I almost can't make heads or tails of it, and I think you could explain it better, was when they finally got in front of the 9/11 Commission, the government 9/11 Commission, the Air Force, NORAD, and the FAA. Now, I guess protocol is the FAA, they represent the air traffic controllers,
mm-hmm,
and the air traffic controllers were the first ones to find out, yeah, there's hijacked planes. They're off course. We radioed them. You know, they know. And then I guess the protocol is the FAA is supposed to notify NORAD. Is that the way it's supposed to go?
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm.
Now, what's the official testimony that we got from the commission on what happened that day? Did the FAA call NORAD? Did NORAD pick up the phone? Did they do anything about it?
Well, this is another place where the commission basically distorted the process. In other words, a typical protocol that's been in place for many decades essentially calls on the FAA to make a report, and if there's an off course or otherwise erratic plane, then the Air Force scrambles jets and gets up and takes a look, and if necessary, intercepts. Now, intercept does not mean shoots down, but it means pull alongside and basically escorts the errant plane to the nearest airport.
Mm-hmm.
But none of this went on, and according to the commission, it didn't go on because the FAA did not make formal reports. So you had a lot of FAA people, controllers and others, calling the military, and sometimes actually calling a base like Otis Air Force Base near Boston, calling directly and asking for help. But basically, it was kind of the formalistic defense that NORAD used. The military basically said, well, yeah, you told us there were some planes, but you didn't make a formal report that then we could send up the chain of command all the way up to the Joint Chiefs or Rumsfeld. So essentially, they created layers of bureaucracy and exaggerated any communication difficulties that were going on.
Did anybody find that completely preposterous, with their hair on fire, going, wait a minute, we have defenses to defend against that. How come? I mean, my head would explode if I heard that in testimony.
Boy, one would think quite a few retired Air Force pilots were totally amazed by this kind of pretext, because they said, well, look, you know, we scrambled planes in 5 or 10 minutes, and, you know, we had F-16s alongside wagging our wings and all of this. I mean, what happened for an hour and a half that they couldn't scramble planes and intercept? And people that were knowledgeable about Air Force practices and protocol were often scratching their heads or just outraged, but there weren't enough of those, and they were marginalized.
There was another piece in your book where you told the story of jet fighter pilots that were chomping at the bit to get up, and they wouldn't let them go up.
Right.
They saw the whole thing unfolding. They were going, let us go, let us go. And their superiors, later on, it was found out, they said that our superiors just wouldn't let us go. So there was actually pilots that were ready to go defend this country, and somewhere from on top, we really don't know who yet, somebody wouldn't let that happen. This seems like a major crime, like it was allowed to happen.
Exactly. One case that we could point to was at Otis Air Force Base, when you had the planes out there, the F-16s sitting on the runway for 12 minutes, and there were two consecutive 6-minute delays. The pilots are, you know, just ready to go. They're in the cockpit, just waiting for a signal, and they just couldn't get clearance to take off, even though airliners were bearing down on the Trade Center in New York. So then when they finally got in the air, they were put in holding patterns rather than allowed to go right over Manhattan. They were just put in holding patterns off Long Island. There were just a series of ridiculous delays that were totally unnecessary.
This is just straight insanity, folks. We're talking to Paul W. Ray, PhD, emeritus professor. He wrote the first book, Still Seeking the Truth About 9/11, Exposing Fallacies in the Official Story. And he's got a brand new book coming out. Is that within a month or two, Paul, or 6 months down the road?
Probably early next year.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it's going to be called Mounting Evidence. And Paul's going to be one of the participants in the 6th Annual 9/11 Truth Film Festival this weekend. You can get all the information on that at sf911truth.org, and a big film festival. It's always a big deal. Every year you guys have it. Now, before we conclude, because radio time is like dog years. It goes by real fast.
Right.
And we've already eaten up 50 minutes. I want to get into the collapse a little bit of these buildings. And, the towers were one thing, and Richard Gage has been on this show before for 2 hours, mm-hmm. and he went through the methodical explanation of how steel frame buildings can't fall down the way they're built from just being hit by a jet or just from fire. No steel frame building has ever fallen down from fire.
That's
and
right.
we were told, one of the stories we were told, that, oh yeah, the jet fuel burned and it melted the steel, and then all that weight came down and it took the whole building down. But let's step beyond that, and let's jump to Building 7. Because this is the one I heard Willie Nelson. Willie Nelson is not a political activist. you know, he likes marijuana, but I mean, he's an advocate for that, but you don't see him jumping around, screaming up, or, you know, doing any political, you know, he's not a, he might be a political guy in his private life, but you don't see him putting it out on the sleeve. And I saw him on Democracy Now, and Amy Goodman asked him, do you have a problem with 9/11 with the story we got? And he said, well, Building 7 didn't make sense, and a lot of us feel that way too. Building 7 was the building, the 47-story tower that wasn't connected to the, it wasn't hit by anything that day. It wasn't physically connected to the towers. It wasn't hit by anything. Yet at 5:30 that afternoon, Building 7 fell, unlike the two towers. It fell in its footprint, meaning the foundation of Building 7 was just eliminated, taken out by whatever means, and it dropped right in its own footprint, as the same way that a building would drop as if done by explosives. Paul, yes. Ray, speak a little bit about what you found out about Building 7.
Right. There's all kinds of very peculiar circumstances surrounding Building 7, starting with the fact that there was no aircraft impact. So right there you had a major discrepancy. I mean, skyscrapers don't just fall down. And then in addition, you have the fact that in the middle of the afternoon, the owner of the building, Larry Silverstein, talked with the head of the New York Fire Department and said, and I'm close to verbatim here, boy, I think there's been so much loss of life here in New York. I think we better just pull it. And pull it is an industry term for demolish a building. And so here's the owner basically telling the fire department, don't fight any fires you see there. And there were some small fires. Just get your men out of there, and we're going to drop this building. So, I mean, this was right on TV, and yet the media, again, has tended to ignore not only that statement, but Building 7 itself. In fact, in Washington, excuse me, in New York right now, there's a huge movement called, you know, Building What? Because so many people are saying, Building 7? I thought there were just two skyscrapers that came down. And the media has just done a total blackout. And, of course, the report doesn't even mention Building 7, the commission's report.
And if the owner said that on camera, that, oh, we might have to take that building down, quite ironic that it would take more than a week to set charges to take a building like that down. How could anyone in the world decide in the afternoon and then by that early evening take that building down, although it appears it was taken down with high explosives?
That's a pretty hard conclusion to avoid when you look at photographs that we have.
Well, there's film of it too, right? Yeah, there's video of it dropping straight into its footprint.
Yeah, exactly.
Didn't
this is
fall
all
over?
Very well laid out on AE 9/11 Truth, the architects and engineers website, very well laid out with these comparative videos.
Richard Gates, can you speak a little bit about the contents of Building 7? What was in Building 7 that might have disappeared that day that might have been important to anybody?
There were a number of government offices, but notably the Securities and Exchange Commission had their office there, and at that time most of their records, which were going to be used as suits against large corporations, were in their office there. And so when the building went down, then the evidence against a number of firms in New York that were under investigation was wiped out.
You mean it wasn't backed up on a computer system somewhere?
No, it was not.
Isn't that coincidental?
Yes.
And, gee, I wonder who those people, who the suits were. And another very strange occurrence, because we're running out of time here quickly. On that day, somebody placed stock puts. A stock put is a bet that a stock is going to go down. You can, in the stock world, you can bet that a stock will go up. You can buy it, hope it goes up. You can also place a put, which will actually you'll benefit if the stock goes down.
Right.
And some secret person who we still don't have the name of, but the name is in a German bank, I do believe, It's been admitted to that, isn't it? Hasn't it?
Oh, I think there's been a lot of documentation.
That they have the name. Somebody has the name, but it hasn't been released yet.
Yeah. Well, there were tens of thousands of people buying puts. On United and American Airlines.
Okay. Yeah, they bought United and American Airlines. They placed puts, and those people greatly benefited from the events of 9/11, didn't they?
Yes, they did.
And that in itself has got to be a big red flag. As a matter of fact, the Securities and Exchange Commission is tasked with investigating stuff like that. When they see a stock deal like, Martha Stewart, and she gets some benefit from a stock deal, well, they put a woman like that in jail, right?
Yeah, right.
But did they even investigate these stock puts? Did anybody get a phone call?
They did a very cursory, very superficial investigation, and the FBI basically jumped to a conclusion that there was no wrongdoing and that there was no insider trading and that sort of thing.
The good old FBI.
Yeah,
oh, man. Right. Then there's a whole case of Colleen Rowley, too. Paul Ray has been our guest for the hour. And just before we conclude, Paul, I'd like you to just take a couple of minutes and let me get, you've written the book, you're involved in the movement, you're going to be at the film festival this weekend. Let me get your take, Paul. Paul W. Ray, what's your conclusion on this? If somebody was just to ask, I'm asking you straight out, what do you think happened?
I tend to be in the position on this four-point scale that I mentioned. In other words, official story, surprise attack, let it happen, helped it happen, made it happen. I tend to be more in the realm of helped it happen, meaning that I do believe that Islamist extremists were involved, that Osama bin Laden did exist, and so forth. But My own conclusion, a tentative conclusion at this point, would be that he had help. And the help came from the CIA, the FBI, and other government entities and officials that we've been talking about.
And since then, we can look back and see where the events of that day have led this country. Right up to today, we have a massive misunderstanding that somebody shouldn't build a mosque at ground zero. It's really not a ground zero. It's two blocks away. And
right.
In the same neighborhood, they have a strip club, too.
But and that's it's not a mosque, either.
Exactly. And that's not, the strip club isn't called the ground zero strip club. And this country's gone so far off the track that I do believe on September 11th, some folks in Florida in a church are going to have a Quran burning.
That
distresses me deeply because
yes.
That could be a kickoff to some very bad events. I mean, if another country had a Bible burning and mocked the Christian religion, would people in this country get upset?
Absolutely. They would probably get bombed, in fact.
Yeah. I would speculate to think the way the United States is now, if somebody burned the Bible and threw it in America's face, they might get bombed. So I think what we're talking about here, these events and this film festival, I don't feel like we're part of, I say we because I'm part of this too, I don't think we're part of a movement that's going to go away or doesn't matter or we're just a bunch of crazies. I think this has to do with current events. And I think if the truth can come out about what really happened that day, it might help the country come to understand. It's been hoodwinked, and it's been kind of sidetracked into a place that it shouldn't even be.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, and the evidence is just all around us. As an example, we now have a new bin Laden, the ultimate public enemy, and he is supposedly residing in Yemen. So now this creates a pretext for why we should be taking military action with predator drones in Yemen. Yet another country.
Terrible stuff. Terrible. Paul Ray, I want to thank you so much for all your good work.
Thank you.
And I want you to keep it up. And we'll be seeing you at the film festival this weekend. And again, if you want to know more about Paul Ray's work, Paul W-R-E-A, Paul Ray. Google his name. The website's coming. The next book, which is called Mounting Evidence, is on the way, too. And, Paul, you just take care in the meantime, okay?
I'll do that, and thank you very much, Bert.
Thank you. You have a nice day.
You too. Bye-bye now.
All right, bye. That has been Paul Ray, right here on KZSU Stanford. This is a special two-hour edition of Shedding Light. The lunch special will resume next week. And a little bit of business to take care of. And then we're going to bring on Mickey Huff of Project Censored. And he wrote an article with Paul Ray just a couple of years ago on that same subject. And then we have a live in-studio guest, Mr. Dana Carson, who's an on-the-ground activist in the 9/11 truth movement. So keep it right there. And I do want to remind you, too, if you need some truthful news that always hits the nail on the head, and it's every day, say an hour, check out Democracy Now!